Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, in which the intelligence hopefully comes from my guests. In this case, I know it will because I just finished reading Edward Sorel's book, Mary Astor's Purple Diary. It's about the great American sex scandal of 1936. First of all, I happen to have been born that year, and so every time I look up what happened that year, this sex scandal actually is one of the items mentioned. And it's a sex scandal in which a well-known, not necessarily the top drawer actress, who had kept a diary and involved her numerous love affairs and details about it. And it came out in a paternity suit here in Los Angeles. And George S. Kaufman, the famous playwright, John Barrymore, the famous actor, Samuel Goldman, the famous movie mogul, are in the book. So let me just ask you, you first found this story ripping up linoleum in your cheapo Manhattan apartment in the days when they still had cheapo apartments. Why don't we just begin with that? Your 50-year love affair with Mary Astor, who, if you could tell me her real name, because she's not one of the Astors that have all the money. It's a made-up name, and she has some German name that I can't remember.
Lillian Langhank.
Oh, well, there you go. I thought there was a middle one. Oh, the father had the von Schmeckel von
Hank. No, he was a Langhank, too, but he had several German names.
Yeah.
I forget them. Otto, Frederick, but three or four really German names. And he was the bad guy.
Yeah.
And he's the reason that Mary screwed up her life, because she really had an abused childhood. But let's get back, let's be linear here and get back to the linoleum. It was 1965. I had just married for the second time. And we were broke, but we found a railroad flat in the East 80s, and the rent was $97.17, and it was rent controlled. And the first thing I had to do, according to my wife, was replace the linoleum in the kitchen, which was rotting. So after I went through three, four, and five layers of linoleum, I came to the wooden floor where there were several copies of the Daily News and Daily Mirror from July 1936. And it was all about this trial in Los Angeles, a custody trial, in which the husband of Mary Astor was going to use a diary that he stole from her that kept track of all her extramarital affairs, one of which she didn't name the men. She simply identified them with the initial of their first name. And G, he was able to figure out, was really George S. Kaufman, who in the 30s was the most successful producer on Broadway. And it was his name rather than her name that caused the headlines, because both of them were married, and his infidelity really didn't count because he was in an open marriage with his wife, and both of them.
Well, he's a male too. There was a sort of double standard, right? And she had
well,
she had been cast
yeah,
as the virgin in the movie business, right?
That's right. Yeah. Her career from the time from silent movies in 1924. Where John Barrymore had chosen her to be his leading lady in Beau Brummel, she had always played virgins.
You let us in on the fact that the sexual revolution did not start in the 60s. It was alive and well in the 20s, and the whole notion of an independent woman demanding to be satisfied was not an invention of the zipless sex of Erica Jong. This is a woman way ahead of her time, raised in a very repressive, exploitive family. Father wanted to take advantage of her having acting skills and take the money and run. And then she just decides, you know, there's a different way to live, and she's got to be part of the enjoyment process. Is that a fair summary?
Well, the idea of demanding to be satisfied, that doesn't get you very far. some men can satisfy and some men can't. And it was the fact that George could, which made her fall madly in love with him. Let me put this as NPR-ish as I can. The reason that he and his wife Beatrice had an open marriage was because sex with George was painful for her, which is not the case with the other men that she had affairs with. And Mary, in her diary, refers to the fact that he fits me perfectly. And so, obviously, George has good equipment, and she was a woman who liked to be satisfied, and oddly enough, she chose husbands that her first husband, as a matter of fact, had no interest in sex whatsoever, I think it's unfair to Mary to say that. She was really looking for love as well as sexual satisfaction.
Oh, but she kept, let's be clear about this. I mean, she kept a diary, which if it's accurate, and we should talk about that, because there was some tinkering with the diary by lawyers trying to use it in the child custody dispute and so forth, and people added pages to it that were not hers. But what emerges, the only reason I'm pushing this is I remember when I was editing Ramparts magazine, and by the way, just full disclosure, you did some of the really brilliant work for Ramparts, this bestiary, which is incredible artwork, and you also did a cover for one of my books. So we've had a professional. I've never met you. But when I was doing Ramparts, we ran an article by Susan Lydon, a well-known writer, on the myth of the female orgasm. Well, was there such a thing? So even in the 60s, there was a lively debate, and I remember Norman Mailer weighed in on that dispute. Yet in your book, we're talking about the early 30s, 1920s, and yeah. Here's a woman who keeps a diary. Whether the part about her rating her love is accurate or not, you don't really answer that question. She denies it. But the fact is, according to this diary, the purple diary that was then introduced and made public by the media, she very clearly is announcing that she had desires and that it was important to her well-being to have them fulfilled. And that was way ahead of the mood of the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I have a sneaking suspicion that part of it was really... She had such an abusive childhood from her parents who denied her other children her own age, so she never understood how American parents treat their children. And it wasn't anything like the way her German fathead father treated her. It didn't allow her any freedom, any thoughts of her own, so that when she was on her own, she was unable to make decisions because she had no training in it. And I just have a feeling that a lot of her sexual searching was a search for love as well as sexual satisfaction. She really was betrayed by most of the people. Kaufman treated her rather well, I thought. He only ended the affair when the scandal broke, and he was a private man, didn't want to be part of a scandal.
When she was going to court in downtown L.A. here, and he was going to be a witness, he did two things. He tried to go to Catalina to be beyond the jurisdiction of a subpoena. And then he got a taxi driver pretending to be taking him, I don't know where, to San Bernardino, to take him to the train station. And then he missed his train to Chicago. He got out of town. Now, okay, I'm not going to say that.
He got out of town because a subpoena had been issued for his for his
coming. Don't you have a drawing? And by the way, I should mention one of the great things about this book is it's illustrated by you with these great drawings. And one of those drawings has him and in the text complaining, "I won't be remembered for my great work. All I'll be remembered." Do you have the exact quote?
Yes.
I'll be remembered.
Nobody's going to remember my plays, my essays, my. All they'll remember is that I screwed Mary Astor.
Is that not a contemptuous dismissal of someone?
No.
People should read the book and decide for themselves, because the book, as opposed to our cranky argument here, is actually a terrific read and very enjoyable. So I don't want to give people the wrong idea.
You've only read my book once.
That's true.
My book requires several readings.
All right, so let me take you back to the beginning. Why the fascination with Mary Astor? Because people listening to this, probably most of them don't know her or don't remember her. So tell us about your lifelong obsession.
When I was starting to do the book, that's what everybody told me. Nobody under 80 is going to give a damn about Mary Astor. They won't have heard of Mary Astor. The truth is that she only was in two good movies in her whole career. She was in over 100 movies. Her career lasted from 1924 in Hollywood to the 50s, late 50s. And as a matter of fact, her plan was to be a featured actress rather than a star. She was offered contracts from RKO and from Paramount to have starring roles, but she didn't want that because she believed that a star's career only lasts about 5 or 8 years, and she wanted a very long career because she was hooked up on money just like her father was. Her father had inculcated her with the idea that money was the only value to have, and she wanted to have a long career. I first saw her in 1939. I was 10 years old, and I saw her in The Prisoner of Zenda, and I had never in my... I had a beautiful mother, but Mary Astor was just so incredibly beautiful. I couldn't believe that anybody could be that beautiful. And so I was kind of interested in her after that, and she had a lovely voice. See, one of the reasons she was named Mary Astor because Famous Players, which became Paramount, was because of her speech. Her father, who was German, and never let her play with other children, kept emphasizing enunciation. So she had a speech that was different from anybody else. And when she auditioned for Famous Players, for Jesse Lasky, he was so impressed with her speech that he assumed that she was upper class. And that's why they named her Astor, because her speech indicated great breeding. And the Mary came from I don't know what, but that's why she was called Mary Astor. But getting back to why she was a terrific actress. Even in Junk, she was a terrific actress. And when I saw her in Dodsworth, a movie that isn't shown very often, it was one of the great Hollywood movies. And her role in it would saved her career, because Dodsworth was filmed at the same time that the trial was going on. And Sam Goldwyn was seriously considering taking her out of the movie on the moral clause in everybody's contract. But he decided that fighting for her daughter, for custody of her daughter, was an honorable thing, and that the public would rally around, which they did.
Well, hold that thought, Ed. It's time for a break, and we'll be back with our guest, Edward Sorrell. Well, we're back with Edward Sorrell, the author of Mary Astor's Purple Diary, The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936. I love the writing in this book, and I'm not talking about your description of Hollywood and how it compared to Broadway and the two coasts, but for example, the Bronx, where I happened to grow up, and you went to the Luxor Theater, which I kind of remember, but then you have a description of the Lower East Paradise. on Fordham Road, where I happened to graduate from Christopher Columbus High School, and you described the stars, the cloud moving. I mean, this was a palace of high culture, and, you know, 800 movies, you say, a year were made, and everybody waited for that. You know, kids waited for the weekend, and on Saturday you got two cartoons, and you got a newsreel, right, and you got two features and the whole thing. And so you're really talking about a world in which, you know, it was sort of the central cultural experience for people growing up. There weren't competitors. There wasn't the internet, and there wasn't television. And these people who became huge stars, and she certainly was one, that were the focus. But what's interesting about your book, she doesn't disappoint. In the more you've learned about her, and you even have an imaginary conversation that I think is a brilliant bit of writing, which I assume is based on your research, right, that you had with her when she's brought back from paradise.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, there's very little made up in that.
Yeah, and it's a terrific vehicle, I think. You know, you always wanted to talk to her, so you brought her into your book. You know, again, I'm trying to sell this book because I think it is really fun. And my wife was reading it, and she said, "This is a great book." So, you know, I really am trying to push it here to anybody listening. And the reason it's great is because it reminds you that America has had this really rich and varied history. So even though, you know, we had the beginning of censorship in the movies and the, you know, role of the Catholic Church and saying you can't do this. And, you know, what was that commission again, the famous commission setting?
The Breen office. It was at first it was called the Hayes office, and then it was called the Breen office. But it was
you have Hayes in your book, though. You have Hayes.
Yeah.
In it. So here's this woman who ends up being a serious Catholic and so forth. But you get this whole sense that we weren't this naive country. We weren't made up of just hicks. People knew about life. They knew about sex. This was not an invention of post-war America or Bohemia, right? And the book is really all about that. These were live ones.
Not only that, fake news isn't something that just happened. It was going on when Upton Sinclair ran for governor of California. He was a socialist, and he was running on the Democratic Party for governor. And the studios were terrified that the socialist was going to tax the studios in order to take care of the unemployed and poor. And so Louis B. Mayer hired Thalberg to create a fake newsreel, which would be shown in all Lowe's theaters, as well as the theaters that William Randolph Hearst owned. And this newsreel purported to show what would happen to California if Upton Sinclair became governor. And there were pictures of thousands of migrant workers showing up for the few jobs that there were, and the crime and everything else. And Sinclair Lewis, who was leading in the polls by double digits, lost the election after this fake newsreel was shown.
Upton,
what did I say?
You said Sinclair Lewis, but that's okay.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant Upton, yes.
Yeah, it's an important scene in your book because the judge in her trial in 1936, or whether she gets to have custody of her child and her career is on the line and everything, is Goody Knight. And Goody Knight goes on to become a lieutenant governor and governor. And the way you set the scene out is reminiscent of, you know, faux populism today and fake news and everything, because the fact that they get the payoff is that Louis Mayer will put this newsreel in the movie theaters, right? Attacking Upton Sinclair. And so therefore, the sitting governor is willing to get word to, you imply at least in the book, to Goody Knight to go easy in the trial.
Well, no, not to go easy, but to keep the contents of the diary closed.
Yeah.
Hollywood studios were terrified that there would be a backlash against Hollywood hedonism, as there was with the Fatty Arbuckle trial. Hearst was always ready in his newspapers to start a crusade, a purity crusade in Hollywood. So they wanted the diary to be kept closed. They couldn't do it completely because a reporter from the Daily News had bribed a clerk in the lawyer's office to photograph the contents of Mary's Astor, those parts of the diary that referred to her affair with Kaufman.
Well, it's a reminder, the more things change, the more they're the same, because here you had powerful media of a sensationalist kind in bed with some politicians, creating them and then suffering at their hands. We have a current analogy in that regard. And, immigrant bashing and the mixture of it. And then another thing you remind us, Hollywood was run largely by Jewish people who changed their names and appearances. And yet, what you don't discuss in the book, but the fact is this is set in the 30s, Hollywood really didn't do very much to tell us what was going on in Germany or what was happening to Jews outside. I mean, it was just for me.
No, because as you know, the producers did not want to lose the German market. They were essentially collaborators with Hitler. And for example, they didn't like the Tarzan movies, and they were very seldom mentioned Jews in their movies anyway, even when the movies were about Jews. They were always concerned about their pocketbooks and their profits. The producers were a money mad lot, and they didn't give a damn about principles, and they would do business with Hitler and anybody else that could give them a profit. It was an ugly business.
Yeah, but it's interesting, just so we don't go overly heavy on Hollywood and California, the great strength of the book in terms of describing communities, I think, is your description of Broadway and life in New York. And, I mean, you have an intimate knowledge of where they ate, and, you know, you start out in a time of prohibition and the restaurants where you could get a drink or not, and you got the Algonquin lunch table and so forth. And you have kind of a love-hate relation to Manhattan, of that Manhattan. I'm just putting too fine a point on it. You have some ambiguity about it.
One of the things I found very sad about it was there used to be a casino, the Central Park Casino, which during Prohibition, Central Park Casino was owned by the city, but since who was the mayor?
LaGuardia.
Was the mayor of
LaGuardia?
No, before LaGuardia, Jimmy Walker yeah. was the mayor of New York, and he was not going to. New York didn't pay any attention to Prohibition, even though there were raids occasionally. But during the reign of Jimmy Walker, the Central Park Casino served liquor, and that's where Mary and George went on their first date. And she describes, even in the diary, how beautiful that casino was, but it was torn down by Mayor LaGuardia, the reform mayor, and his urban planner, Robert Moses, because they didn't believe that a restaurant, a casino restaurant in Central Park, should be for the rich, which of course it was. But surely there was a more satisfactory solution to making it for the people than tearing it down. But that's what they did. They tore down the Central Park Casino, and if you see photographs of it, it was a gorgeous Victorian building.
The book is worth reading for many reasons, but one certainly is your familiarity and your describing the life of New York, whether it's Dorothy Parker, you know, at the Algonquin, whether it's the Essex House, whether it's being in a carriage where she is with Kaufman, you know, at 5 in the morning, going through Central Park. I mean, the whole thing. You know that town. You own that town. And we're going to run out of time here, but I just, for people who don't know your work as well as I do, you've been incredibly successful as an illustrator, as a cartoonist, as an artist, an illustrator. And you actually were involved in a very important activity, I think, from a graphics point of view with Milton Glaser on, what was it, Pushpin or...
Yeah, it was Pushpin Studios with Seymour Quast, Milton Glaser, and me.
And you redesigned magazines in America, didn't you? I mean, it was the heyday of magazines.
I get too much credit for being part of Pushpin. The truth of the matter is I left after 2 years, and the greatest work that they did was done after I left. So I don't want to take too much credit. Yes, we did start a studio that had an enormous influence for a while, but... it was the work that I did as a freelancer, just by myself, that I'm proudest of.
Yeah, so just as we conclude, though, this book evokes the old days. And frankly, reading them, I mean, this is way before my time even, basically we're talking about life in the 20s and 30s, and you can read it and think, wow, that would have been a great time to be alive. For all of its failings, all of its contradictions, there was energy. The libido was stroked. People fell in love. People had big ideas. Music dominated.
Well, it was the last time that we had real love songs. I mean, we went from You in the Night and the Music to Let's Do It in the Road. I mean, it was a lovely romantic time. Also, everybody seemed to be poor, so there was a sense of we're all in this together kind of thing that you have in wartime. You also have during a depression. It was an odd time.
I just want to end with one story, because when I picked up your book, Mary Astor's Purple Diary, The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936. The first thing I did was Google Mary Astor to see if she was related to Brooke Astor. have you ever met Brooke Astor? No.
No.
Oh, but she's a New York socialite and an interesting woman. And anyway, she wasn't related. Mary Astor's a made-up name, and Brooke Astor is connected with a big Astor.
Yeah.
Family. But it's interesting, it's sort of, I was a little disappointed because I remember one evening being at some party, I think it was at Lally Weymouth's house, to drop names. Her mother was the head at Washington Post, I think, and Jason Epstein had arranged it. And it wasn't the book you illustrated of mine, but it was another one on nuclear weapons and all sort of thing. And I got to this party, and then Lally or somebody said, no, you have to sit over there, and we're going to move you from table to table because my book was there. And so I found myself sitting next to Brooke Astor, and I couldn't resist because I just came in a cab and I'd been on a plane and it was raining outside. And I said, well, as long as I'm sitting here, I want to ask you what you think about the way Nelson Rockefeller died. Okay. And for those who don't know, he died having sex with an inappropriately younger woman that he that worked for him. And Brooke Astor said, this was my motivation in picking up your book, because I thought at that moment they were connected. And she said, oh, and she was talking about that woman. She said, that silly girl, you never call the 911 number. The Rockefellers had people to take care of that sort of thing, you know? And then when I read your book, even though this woman had no connection with the Astors or big money or power, that idea was still in the air, you know? These people can take care of things, and the public doesn't need to know about it. You don't need scandal.
You're talking about the studios now.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And again, it's the more things change, the more they remain the same. This is an incredibly fast wonderful read. And in one, I mean, I just want to say you have literary devices that I haven't really seen before. You intrude, well, not intrude, you include yourself in the narrative.
Intrude is the right word.
Well,
yes.
I don't think, because it doesn't feel intrusive. You put yourself in the book in ways that illuminate the point. And then you have this device of actually she's sent down from heaven to talk to you, and she's incredibly charming. Right? She says, Eddie, you know, you don't look well, and what's the matter with you? Are you having fun? And I don't know, that particular device you have in the book, I would just say, I finally get Mary Astor, and I realize this book made me, I guess, have a crush on Mary Astor. And so I understand your 50-year or 60-year fascination with that woman. And hope people go out and buy the book, Mary Astor's Purple Diary, The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936. This has been another edition of Sheer Intelligence, where Edward Sorrell provided the intelligence. Our producers are Joshua Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. Kat Yore and Mario Diaz are the great engineers that bring the show to you. And we'll be back next week. Sacamos